Abu Bakr Abed, we want to thank you so much for being with us. A Palestinian journalist, 22 years old, speaking to us from Deir al-Balah in Gaza, has been diagnosed himself with malnutrition. And Sharif Abdelkaddous, my deepest gratitude. Thank you for all of your work. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Hi, this is Al McFarlane, host of The Conversation with Al McFarlane. You're listening to 90.3 FM, KFAI, Minneapolis. I am Al McFarland. Welcome to The Conversation with Al McFarland. I'm glad to be here and glad to have you along as well. Today is Tuesday, March 25th, 2025. And as always, we promise a robust conversation. Today, I have the good fortune of bringing a new friend and a colleague, a member of a training and development cohort. We both are members of a project called Ascend at the Carlson School of Business and associated with MEDA, formerly known as Metropolitan Economic Development Association. We're business owners that are attempting to enjoy and learn and gain the benefit of a specialist in growing our businesses, taking our businesses to the next level. So let me introduce you to my colleague and compatriot, Shane Solier. Shane Solier is the president and CEO of Big Spirit, Inc. Big Spirit is American Indian owned and operated and operates in the arena of marketing and media development and more. Shane, welcome to the conversation. How you doing, my friend? And you have to unmute. There we go.
Okay. Am I unmuted?
Yes, you are.
Okay. Well, let me give you a proper Ojibwe greeting and say bonjour. It's good to see you, my friend.
And will the response be Miigwech?
Miigwech would be just as fine, just as good. Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much. Welcome. Yeah. So, talk about your business. I want this to be a place where people learn about you, your vision, your products, your services, and for me, it's important that we people, Native American and other so-called marginalized communities, always advance our presence, our capabilities into the marketplace. And that's why we're here today. So talk about Big Spirit.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. Big Spirit, we've been around for about 13 years. We bring visions to life through culturally conscious marketing. What that means is, we help organize with our clients to clarify their vision, align their goals, and transform their brand through expert branding, promotional products, and, as you said, multi-channel marketing. As a Native American business, we specialize, kind of our focus areas are within nonprofits, educational institutions, and state agencies, because we understand their unique values and the cultural perspectives that shape their missions. We've been around for about 13 years, and our reputation, I'm honored to say, has been built around personalized service, reliability, creative solutions, and strategic marketing expertise that typically you get that with a large agency. My vision for the business when I started it was to be able to bring that to smaller folks within a cost-effective bubble, and we collaborate closely with our clients to make sure that we honor their brand story through high impact design and products.
So what are the deliverables? What do you deliver to your clients, and what do you deliver to consumers on behalf of your clients?
So we have three key areas or expertise areas that we have. So we have graphic design and branding. Mm-hmm. So to give some context to that, we design the logo and the state license plate for the Minnesota's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives. We do promotional products. some capacity in that is we did the last state fair, we did scratch offs for the Minnesota State Lottery at the state fair. And we also supply thermal bags, branded thermal bags for food banks. And then we do a new service that we've added this year is we do printing, binding, and fulfillment services. So we customize journals, sustainable notebooks. And then we have done things like national campaigns where we've printed 30,000 plus printed materials for initiatives around veterans. So that what we're trying to deliver around those areas is that delivering confidence, reliability, and transformation around every project so that our clients' visions are met and that they make a lasting impact on their community, which is community is a very important part of our values.
I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland. My guest is Shane Solier. He's president and CEO of Big Spirit, Inc. Shane, thank you again for being with us. Thank you so much. You know, so what brought you into this business? What is your beginning? How did you become Big Spirit?
I built a career as an executive in marketing for since I've left college. In 2008, when everything kind of turned down, I was looking for more mission-based, purposeful business. I wanted to do things within my culture. I wanted to give back to kids because I wasn't blessed with my own kids. And I wanted to use the expertise vehicle that I have to make a larger impact in my community. And so the opportunity to kind of consult with my local community here in South Minneapolis, with the Native American organizations, blossomed into lots of projects, which then built relationships. A lot of things that come to us are through referrals, and then in hand, building those relationships that's so important for us and our mission. We've continued to kind of build that package around full support in marketing for our clients. And it's been successful for 13 years. So we're excited. And then some exciting things are happening coming through in the near future, including the cohort thing that we're a part of, which I'm really excited about. And even if I've been in business for 13 years, this cohort is opening my eyes to many things that
I just Same for me. You know, I'm 77 years old. And what I discovered is that you're never too old to learn. And that learning is a lifelong process. And as long as you're breathing, there's an opportunity to know more, to learn more, and to be better at what you do. And so I'm really pleased to be part of it. But I'm so excited to talk to you about something I think about a lot, Shane. And I think about culture, what culture means to us. I can tell you what it means to me, and I'd love to have you reflect on what it means to you and how it shows up in your mission and in your work. To me, my experience as an African in the New World, that's how I've described myself as an African-American or African in the New World. Mm-hmm. My experience was that the society or the social structure at large tended to and was comfortable pushing my identity, my sense of being to the margin, squeezing it out of the arena of vitality in life, and therefore to be myself and to do business was always a struggle. Maybe it's a struggle for every human being, but I looked at it through the lens of my experience as a product of the transatlantic slave trade. So when I went out into the market to become a newspaper owner, publisher, businessman, I challenged the notion that culture meant white culture, meant European culture, and that European culture was the standard for humanity. My approach is to say that all of us bring value and bring validity to the human experience, and no culture is superior nor inferior to another. Each is a gift and brings gifts. And so I challenge that what I call sense of privilege and supremacy that European white culture operates in from my point of view. And I bring to it a firm voice about the validity, the power, the beauty and the organic nature of the culture that I come out of. So that's my story. You use the word culture too. What does culture mean for you?
You know, I feel I am blessed to have a very rich culture. And it's important to say that my mother is of European descent. My father is the Native American part of it. I think both of those bring a very rich connection and relationship. What I see as culture is a broader perspective of just understanding the culture of all things, not just Black, white, Hispanic, but an understanding of the values that people have in their own kind of being and their perspective on things. Be it in my perspective, I bring an understanding. One of the levels of understanding is as a Native American celebrating certain traditions like smudging, something I do daily in order to clarify and clear my mind to, in order to be able to focus and bring the best to the work that I do and to be able to help my clients pull out their story and whatever journey we're taking to get them.
I don't know what smudging is, so tell me what that means.
So smudging is a tradition, Native American tradition, and I think it happens in other cultures, but we burn sage or cedar, different herbs that help. Sage is a primary one to help clarify the and clean out the spirit. It's something that people use to go around their houses and kind of clear out negative energies. It's just something that is very rich in the culture that natives do in a number of capacities, just to clear out things in the journey that's ahead, either for that day or at that moment or throughout the things that they're trying to do. Al, did I lose you?
No, we're still here. Go ahead.
Al, did I lose you?
No, I hear you perfectly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what smudging is. But in regards to kind of going back to the cultural piece, the importance to me is I grew up with my mother, didn't have the early experience of growing up my father in the Native American culture. So being in South Minneapolis in the cultural corridor purposely, there's so many rich programs and there's a strong presence of natives here. And I wanted to get involved with the things that I can bring to the table as a marketer and also at the same time learn from them cultural elements that I were either missing or are learning to enrich who I am as a person.
Okay. So do you have any of your products around you there? Do you have things that you can show us at all?
Do I have anything around me? I have a slide I could show you some things if I can share. Otherwise,
I think you can. Our producer, and you have to. So two things: we're doing video right on YouTube, but we're also having to reach the mind's eye of our radio listeners. Absolutely. On KFAI. So yeah, if you can share, go ahead and walk us through to tell us what you've got, but describe it in a way that the listener sees it as well.
Okay. Yeah. So I'll just bring, let's see if I can bring my video around to my screen here. What I want to show is, for those that don't know the missing and murdered indigenous movement, or let's see if you can see this. I don't know if it's going to be great. So this is the logo that we created for the state. Some of the promotional products that we presented and then were used at different events, say at the state, capital, other things. We did water bottles, we did bandanas, we did individual first aid kits, which were some. We did fans. We do fans for powwows and other things. This is the license plate that we created, which I'm very proud of. And I have that on my license plate, as does my family. So there was an initiative by a legislator that wanted this for the organization. This, what you see here, is a ribbon dress, a flowing mm-hmm. ribbon dress on the right that we created. Mm-hmm. So we designed that. And I'm happy to say that that is the currently the third most popular license plate being sold out there in the state of Minnesota. So very happy about that. And if people are looking to get one, I highly encourage you to get that because it goes back to the mission and the purpose of the organization. Then other things that we've designed things for the DNR, banners, large retractable banners for events. We worked with an organization, the National Boarding School Association. They have a program going around the nation that is about talking about boarding schools, trying to recognize the things that our elders went through boarding schools, Native boarding schools, which were horrific things. And we created a program that is a traveling display, large display in the back that is of school kids, Native school kids, and then different retractable banners that speak to the elements of the organization. So that's something that we've created. We work with, again, educational institutions. So we've done tablecloths. We did they did a fun thing, Anishinaabe Academy, young kids, elementary kids. They have a program that they do that kind of wanted to make it like a superstar situation. So they did this backdrop and we designed a logo for completely new for their athletic teams. And then we helped redesign their current logo. And we put that on. We do fundraisers for them all the time with apparel to try to help raise money and give back. Let's see, we That's did. Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. So there's other things. We did some things for the police, challenge coins, those types of things. So we do a number of design and then promotional products, printing and producing.
Okay. So Shane, thanks for hanging out with me. Thank you so much for explaining and showing. And again, I'm so happy that we're connected now through our common effort to improve and grow our businesses by being part of the cohort of the Ascend program at the University of Minnesota Carlson School of Business. And Mita, thank you so much. How do people reach you? Let's how they connect with you.
You know, I have this slide up, so I'll put this up so they can see it. But they can learn about the business at bigspiritinc.com, mm-hmm. which is an overall explanation of the business. Our online catalog, if you're looking for branded goods, promotional and apparel, is at bigspiritpromo.com. Mm-hmm. And then we're also on social media and Instagram and Facebook and LinkedIn at Big Spirit Inc. Or people can reach me at shanes@bigspiritinc.com or give me a call. I'd love to help others in the community kind of build up what they're trying to do, clarify and understand their vision and then help them build their community around the initiatives that they're trying to do. And I appreciate the opportunity, Al. This is awesome.
Well you got to give the phone number if they want to call you. Yeah, what's the number?
612-713. Actually, that is 612-713-9456. Again, that's 612-713-9456.
Shane,
thanks for holding me accountable on that.
Thank you, my friend. We'll see you. Take care.
All right, Al. Take care. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye. I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland, and so happy to have that conversation with Shane. And my intention is to invite all of the members of our cohort to show up on this show just to talk about the phenomenal businesses we are creating and the phenomenal ways to engage and to help create value, to build wealth. All of us, I think, are about building generational wealth, building ways to become and present ourselves not as the problem, but as the solution. And we believe that the gifts that we have been endowed with are gifts that can heal and build our community. Let me shift the focus and bring in my next guest, a friend who also is doing magnificent work in the pursuit of understanding of justice. And that's Justin Terrell. He is the leader at the Minnesota Justice Research Center. Justin, good afternoon, my brother. Good to see you again. How are you?
I'm good, Al. Thank you for having me on. How are you today?
I'm doing really well, and thank you for jumping on. You know, I talked to you a little earlier this morning as I was checking on the press conference you guys did recently. Walk us through the announcements that you were making and the energy that you're putting out into the community that you did recently, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot to talk about. So First, I feel like it's good for folks to know who we are, the Minnesota Justice Research Center. We're a small nonprofit focused on rigorous research, bringing people together through our education efforts, and then developing policies that folks that will have a meaningful impact in people's lives and help transform the criminal legal system in the state of Minnesota. And so we're part of a larger coalition of 40 organizations who align with that mission of transforming the criminal legal system. And we currently have 14 bills moving through the legislative process at the state capitol. Last week, we had our day on the Hill, where, you know, I think we had between 60 to 100 folks come out. We had young people, we had our elders, we had students, we had, you know, everyday working professionals, organizers. It was a beautiful crowd that we were able to bring together, and we met with lawmakers, met with AG Ellison, who endorsed our full agenda, met with Representative Long, who's in leadership in the House, and Cedric Frazier, who's authored several bills that we're advocating for. And we had a committee hearing on one of our bills, which was is a bill to change how we collect data around pretrial in the state. This is one of the recommendations that we've offered from our pretrial, our Reimagining Pretrial report that the state commissioned us 18 months ago. And so it was a busy day. It was a lot of fun. We got our bill through committee. We did a press conference. A lot of people that we brought to the Capitol was their first time there. So we did a lot of education, and lawmakers felt supported. Folks who support our policies felt supported, and folks who tend to oppose us, I think, had a good experience with the folks that we brought to the Capitol. So we're, you know, trying to build so we can win regardless who's in charge.
Walk us through some of the bills that you have sponsored or you're supporting. Give us an idea of what our listeners here on KFAI and those who are connecting on our social media platform should be aware of, and how it, explain it in a way that allows us to also motivate and to support the important initiatives that you are bringing forward.
So my lobbyist might be able to do a better job than that on that topic, but I'll do my best here. So I think it's important to, for folks to know what we've worked on in the past, so people understand what our track record is. And so at the Minnesota Justice Research Center, you know, we led the outreach effort to include community input to advise the Commissioner of Human Rights on what should be negotiated in a consent decree in the city of Minneapolis. And so I get a lot of questions about the DOJ, but I think it's really important to remind community members that we have a consent decree in place in the city of Minneapolis that was designed by community members in the city of Minneapolis and negotiated by Rebecca Lucero, the Commissioner of Human Rights. And if you look at that document, it sets a much higher bar than the DOJ would have ever set. And so that's one piece of work that I just really hope people feel confidence in. And if they have questions, we're always happy to engage on. As far as legislation goes, you know, we've supported the passing of restoration of voting rights with our research. So if you are formerly incarcerated in the state of Minnesota today, and you're thinking about the next election coming up, which is going to be an important one, the midterms, as long as you're out of prison and haven't received any like very, very specific, minute restrictions on your voting rights, you can vote in the state of Minnesota if you have a criminal history. One in five Minnesotans has a criminal history. I think that's about 1 million people in our state have a criminal history, and they all should be heading to the polls. So those are some examples of bills we've supported in the past. Now, today, what we have is we have 14 bills, so I'm not going to go into all of those with the coalition. Our pretrial work is top of our list. We want to see a complete reimagination of people's experience in pretrial. So that starts with collecting data, which is the bill that we have moving through session right now. Right now, we don't know what, I mean, one of our elders died in jail last year, right? And so, and there's just not a lot of data around what happens in the pretrial process.
Let's stop, stop. Just setting that, who died and what were the circumstances and what is the learning that has to come out of it?
Yeah, so I don't want to go into details because I don't want to disrespect anyone's family. Mm-hmm. But one of our elders connected to the Penumbra Theater, it's all public information, you can look into it. Mm-hmm. You know, died in jail. I believe it was, you know, neglect of medical conditions and mm-hmm. Folks weren't
able. It was a big story. I think people.
It's a huge story. Yeah. And so I just want to, you know, use that as an example. I try to be sensitive because I'm not media. I'll let you tell the story. So, but I, you know, we've lost elders in our county jails. County jails are often used to warehouse inmates from prisons, where we know that jails don't have the same amount of services, but it generates revenue for the local counties. The pretrial process and how race plays a factor in if your bail is low or if your bail is high. We know that, you know, the goal is to get people to come back to pretrial. No one wants people to skip their court date. So the research that we've dug into is really about how do we create a more equitable process that enhances liberty. And so and it's work that we're very proud of. I mean, we traveled all over the state, traveled all over the country, spoke to judges in every judicial district in our state, spoke to people who paid bail, because what we found in the research is that a lot of folks don't want to talk about that experience. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, right now, if you are the dope man, and, you know, I ain't knocking no one's hustle, but if you're the dope man, you got a bunch of money in a shoebox under your bed and you get picked up, you can pay your bail. And if it's somebody who, if you're talking about a single mom with a kid at home who works three jobs, you know, lives check to check, doesn't have any money stacked up, and they get picked up on, you know, something petty that requires them to sit in jail for the night, they can't pay their bail and go home. And so we have a system that Brian mm-hmm. Stevenson says, we have a criminal justice system that treats you better if you are rich and guilty than if you are poor and innocent. And so our research is really designed at addressing that issue in the pretrial system. So that's one of our bills. We're also working on traffic stops. Valerie Castile is testifying on that tomorrow. We're advocating for the end of solitary confinement in our prisons. That's a big topic that I'm happy to talk more about. We also are looking at—
Let's talk about it. I think that's a good one. You know, tell me what's the condition, what's the scenario that makes this rise to need the address of the community.
Yeah, so this also dovetails with another issue we need to talk about in community. So one, let's start, I'm gonna start high level. So if we're running out of time, you might have to cut me off, Al. But no, high level.
We got plenty of time, let's go.
All right, let's go, I'm yeah. in. So high level, we have a criminal legal system, not a justice system. We have a criminal legal system. So these are the structures in charge of enforcing the laws in our society, right? And if you violate those laws, you face a penalty, right? The problem is the penalty. The problem is that we take a punitive approach to how we administer justice in our society. And that is not a good idea for governments in America. As we look at the history and how our criminal legal system has been used to penalize certain folks and turn a blind eye to other folks' behavior or violations.
Let me jump in and ask, is there a clinical definition of justice? We use the term all the time, but I don't know that we've taken the time to say, when we say justice, what do we mean? And so are there various interpretations of what the word justice means and the idea of justice means?
This is my favorite question. And usually I'm the one asking it, Al. So I appreciate you asking me this question for once. So the reality is that the average person out here doesn't have like a working definition of justice. You know, we can chant in the streets. You know, I used to be an organizer and let thousands of folks in the streets and marches. What do we want? Justice? When do we want it now? Well, we never talk about what justice is. At the MNJRC, and keep in mind, I'm not a lawyer, right? I'm a community organizer, I'm a social worker, that's my background. But at the JRC, what we talk about is justice being fair processes, having equitable distribution of resources. Some folks talk about punishment. We replace punishment with the concept of accountability, which is a relational thing, right? That is, I can't hold you accountable if I'm not in relationship with you, right? And so there's a requirement in justice that we are in relationship with each other in order to hold each other accountable. And the last component of justice that we focus on is restoration. So whenever possible, when harm has been caused. We should be looking for opportunities to restore folks. So a lot often what we do is, you know, if you picture the scale of justice, you have, you know, this idea of balancing the scale of justice so things are fair, equitable, people are held accountable, systems are held accountable, and we restore folks. Well, the reality is what we do is we chop off one half of that scale and we put it in a box. And then we call that justice, because, and it leaves an imbalance. Victims or survivors get very little in the system. Folks who have caused harm in society get very little opportunity, if any, to atone for what they did. They just are succumbed to punishment, which is why folks like Daniel Sered advocate for adopting an accountability lens instead of a punishment lens when it comes to our criminal legal system. Punishment really serves no purpose. The reality is, if you take somebody, and let's be real, like I come from South Minneapolis, grew up South Minneapolis, spent a lot of time on the North Side. If you take somebody on the block whose loved one has been murdered, heaven forbid, if you ask that family what punishment you would like to lend out to the person who caused that level of harm and trauma, the reality is that, you know, Daniel Sered tells a story about a woman who said, I would like to drown the boys who jumped her son. I'd like to drown them in a river. And she said, actually, I'd like to burn them alive. Actually, I'd like to drown them in a river of fire. The reality is that the system can't offer or deliver on retribution for folks who feel wronged in society. And so we're taking the wrong approach in how we approach these things. So in the case of solitary confinement, you know, we know that this is a torturous behavior. You can read Foucault and Durkheim and go back all the way to Europe and look at the way that the white folks developed these innovative ideas and strategies for how to torture and publicly execute each other with mob violence. And that's what's influencing our criminal legal system in 2025. What we're suggesting is that we get creative and come up with other ways to protect safety in these institutions and then make sure that we don't treat people like animals, because when you do treat them in like animals, and I spend a lot of time with formerly incarcerated folks, they will tell you that if you treat us like animals, we're gonna act like animals, and it's y'all versus us, it's gonna be a problem. And so another issue connected to solitary confinement, outside of just like the ethical issue of not using punishment as an excuse to torture people in solitary, and you're talking about long sentences, there's folks who have spent years in solitary confinement. But the other issue is we have, you know, a deteriorating state prisons population. So we have $1 billion. With a looming state deficit, we have $1 billion in deferred maintenance costs for state penitentiaries. Now, Elon Musk is running around the White House looking for ways to cut resources and whatnot. And the reality is, in the state of Minnesota, we have an opportunity to actually save money by working towards closing one or possibly two prisons over the next chunk of time here that could have a huge impact on our looming deficit. Now, here's the thing people need to understand about this is that, and some of my friends are going to take issue with what I say here, but you have to understand that in a state of 5 million people, we have less than 10,000 people in prison. That's not mass incarceration. We utilize probation, we utilize other strategies to make sure we hold people accountable in community and try to utilize prisons for, you know, the most dramatic, most necessary cases. You know, some would recommend, and I think I'd be one, that we should use prisons only for violent offenses and try to address all the other mitigating concerns or factors in community. So we could close a prison in this state, and it's not a soft on crime approach. Now, if you cross the river into Wisconsin, they have three times as many people in prison. That is mass incarceration. And so I think it's important for us to understand the difference, because when you start talking about closing a prison, people think, oh, you just want to let everybody out of prison. I'm like, nah, I think we can close a prison, add zero new beds, and our prison population is stable enough that we have the facilities available. And the reality is the prisons that we have, like Stillwater, where it's 150 degrees in people's cells in the summertime, and when they refuse to go into that cell, they get sent to solitary confinement. Well, I think that, you know, reality is we should close that facility if we're not going to fix it. We have a responsibility to offer humane environments for people who we sentence to be residents in those facilities. So these are a few things that we're working on. Yeah.
So here's what I fear, Justin. I fear that the plan, we can call it, was it 2025?
Oh, yeah.
That is percolating and being implemented by the administration in Washington is for an increased use of the justice system to incarcerate more people. And the more that they likely will incarcerate will be those that they have otherized. They otherize people that are not European, that are not white, that haven't bought into, you know, the idea of white supremacy. That's what I think. And so while you say Minnesota has a unique opportunity to reduce the number of prison beds and to still maintain a process and a system for building public safety and engaging people that have violated the public trust, the public good through criminal activity, there's a competing interest in continuing creating hysteria about the propensity of the other to be a criminal. I mean, that's what President Trump is doing, is saying that all the people that he wants to deport back to across the southern border are coming in because they're criminals and they're rapists, and just these gross generalizations that really denigrate the entire culture. And from the skin of a Black man, of an African man, I'm taking this as if this is a blanket indictment of all people of color, of Black people in particular. What do you think about that? And what, I mean, how should I be looking at this?
I think you have to look at it that way. So, you know, 501c3 nonprofit speaking over here, so I'm not going to get into the politics.
Yep.
But I will say this, that this is why we don't want to use a punitive lens for our criminal legal system, for our justice system. The reality is that when you use a punitive lens, the folks who have their hands on the levers of power will use that to their to serve their interest, right? Mm. So for a long time as a Black man in this country, like, we were, you know, target number one, right? Like, it was I grew up in the 90s. And I remember, you know, I mean, hip hop wrote plenty of songs. Ice Cube talked about the ghetto bird, the helicopters flying overhead. And, you know, we had, you know, the LA riots and images of law enforcement kicking in people's doors and whatnot. And we were dealing with that. I grew up in South Minneapolis. We were dealing with that in the 30s, right? And you can talk to Reggie and those guys and they will tell you all about it. And so we saw a weaponization of the criminal legal system to target Black communities, strip our communities of resources. Another sinister piece that doesn't get spoken about enough, and we have a bill on this issue as well, is if you ever look at the failure to investigate non-fatal shootings, right? So you have a shooting, if there's a non-fatal shooting, it doesn't get the same attention as a fatal shooting. Well, at that point, you're basically facilitating violence in our communities. When you fail to investigate and charge and prosecute sexual assault against Black women, well, you're facilitating the next sexual assault. And then the community loses faith in these systems. And then we start taking it into our own hands to deal with the folks who have hurt our loved ones. And now we're all locked up. That's what the new Jim Crow was doing in our communities. And right now, with the focus on immigration, all I have to say is to remind Black folks and white folks and any folk paying attention, I don't care who you voted for. Angela Davis said it best, if they come for me in the morning, they will come for you in the evening. And so if you think that right now, this administration's efforts that you disagree with, but it's focusing on some, you know, somebody who processed an issue that you disagree with, or somebody whose status in this country is questionable, these issues that exclude you from being targeted, so to speak, like, I think you're kidding yourself, because once they're done dealing with that, they're going to, if you don't serve their purposes, they're going to deal with you too. Look at the colleges and institutions all over this country. You know, I would question to see if Liberty University, right, is dealing with the same kind of pressure that Columbia University is dealing with right now. I mean, it's just no one is actually safe when we get into these situations where folks are using our government to serve personal interests. And this is why I maintain that we need to reimagine how we administer justice to remove the punitive lens and start talking about how we're holding folks accountable. Because frankly, accountability is the best we can do anyways. The punishment will never satisfy those who have been harmed.
Mm-hmm. So did we answer the question? I'm just thinking back on what is justice?
Yeah, I'll say, I love this question. I'll say it a million times. Justice is fair processes, equitable distribution of resources. It is holding systems and people accountable, and it is seeking restoration whenever possible. If you're not trying to do all of those things in the process, then you are not seeking justice. And you can insert, you know, this is Keith Ellison, who is, you know, I would love to consider him a mentor. I consider him a friend, right? He, in his response to after sentencing Derek Chauvin, when they asked him if justice was served, he said he was held accountable. And frankly, that's a very high bar when you consider the history of how officers are treated after the murder of innocent unarmed Black man, right? The fact that we were able to hold one accountable is significant. And that's something I can tell my kids about as they grow older. When they have questions about justice, I can say, here's an example of a Black man who held an officer accountable, one of the most significant cases in the history of our country. And that's the model that I think we need to hold up and we need to strive for and to exceed, by the way.
I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland. I'm talking with Justin Terrell. He is the team leader, executive director, I think is the right title, at the Minnesota Justice Research Center. And we're talking about the question of justice, what it is, and the work that his organization is doing. It's a nonprofit, but doing critical research and advancing the public discussion, public knowledge about how we both define and work for justice for everybody in community and in society. And Justin, let me say that if you're listening on KFAI and have a question, jump on your social media platform, either Facebook or LinkedIn or YouTube, and find this conversation, and you can put a question or a comment in the chat. We want to hear from you. And if you can, just let us know where you're listening from. We appreciate you connecting with us on social media. And obviously, we love that you're here with us in the KFAI community. By the way, I always want to just give kudos to this station, to this asset, this resource that brings community to life every day, all day long. KFAI, support us. And enjoy us. We are doing great work here at KFAI. So you were listing other things that you are advancing at the state legislature. I don't know if you got through the entire list, but if there are more that you want to bring up.
I can't go through the whole list. Frankly, I don't want to misspeak on anything. Some of the other issues I can lay out real quick is we're advocating for, with our partners who are advocating for more funding for victim services. We're advocating for to evaluate the use of mandatory minimums on felony gun possession. That's one I can elaborate on just a little bit. So
go ahead.
Yeah. So 80% of the there's this phenomenon where the police pull somebody over and they find out someone with a felony who's formerly incarcerated and they're in possession of a gun, and that's a violation of the conditions of their release. And so that individual is then, so first of all, we all high five, we got a gun off the street, right? Which is good news. But then that individual, 80% of those individuals are Black men, and that in Hennepin County, and that individual typically faces a 5-year mandatory minimum based on his violation. And so often our approach is, you know, the dominant response in these in when people see these cases is like, well, he shouldn't have had a gun, and you know, we got a gun off the street, high five, yay public safety. And our approach is to really say, well, if 80% of these folks are Black men, are we just going to rest on the idea that Black men are more dangerous and carry guns and are scary? Like, that's a white supremacist idea that we should dismiss outright. And we should interrogate what's going on here. So we have a population that knows that they're breaking the law, but they're not using these guns. So these guns are often not used in crimes, but people are using them to, you know, because like, hey, I have a felony. I can't get a job. I got to keep one foot in the streets if I'm going to feed my family, because even a dog feeds its family. And if, as a Black man, you got kids, you're going to see, I'm going to be better than the dog. I'm going to feed my family. So you keep one foot in the streets. If you got one foot in the streets, you're going to need something on your hip. This is a rational, this is rational, right? Like if these brothers could come out of prison, get a degree and go get a job downtown at Target Corporate, that's different. You know what I'm saying? But we know that that's not a real opportunity. And so often people end back up in the streets and end up carrying a pistol. Now, I'm not saying that I condone that behavior. What I'm saying is that it is actually rational, and we should look at why. If we can understand why people are doing this, then we can have a conversation about what is necessary to get people to stop doing it. Clearly, being threatened with 5 years over your head isn't changing this behavior, which is another issue with how we talk about justice. Often we take deterrence as the primary approach. So if we have stricter penalties, then people won't commit these crimes. And that is just the most naive way to approach public safety. You should never assume that if someone knows they're going to face a stiff penalty, that they won't commit that crime. The bottom line is, you got these kids who's out, been out here carjacking for years, and it's not like they weren't aware of the penalties coming their way if they got caught. The reality is people have different motivations for committing crime, and we should be adults and interrogate those reasons and try to come up with creative responses to change that behavior, which is, you know, a pound of an ounce of prevention becomes a pound for the cure. If you're serious about creating safe communities, at some point we can't just like mandatorily sentence people to 5 years in prison for possession when somebody who uses a pistol, right, in their first time offense, could potentially get less time in prison. That is backwards and upside down. And it displays a lack of serious commitment to actually advancing public safety. It does show a commitment to making sure we catch every Black man with an illegal pistol out here, right? Like, and we know that the same efforts are not applied in what, you know, predominantly white communities across the state, where having a gun is, you know, would never, doesn't even send off an alarm for a police officer, because that's just how the culture is.
It's what's expected. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, yeah. Exactly. I appreciate the question, though, Al. Thank you.
Well, so one more area that I wanted you to talk about, because our first guest earlier talked about it in terms of being a designer, creating materials for important initiatives. You talked about the creative he did for missing and murdered Indigenous or American Indian women. And there is another group that's based on that model called Missing and Murdered Black Women and Girls. And in fact, there's going to be a Missing and Murdered Black Women's Day, Black Women and Girls Day on the Hill. It's going to be Wednesday, April 9th at the State Capitol Rotunda. I don't know if you're involved directly in that, but I know that's one of the things that you got to be interested in. Can you speak to that at all?
Well, now you're making me put on my previous hat. So before becoming the executive director of the Minnesota Justice Research Center, I was the executive director of the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage, where that conversation where the conversation on missing and murdered Black women and girls began was really, you know, with Rena Moran and Ruth Richardson and whatnot. And so obviously I've been a supporter of both of these agencies in their inceptions. And so I think it's very important. So we're promoting the event on April 7th. And I actually just met with DPS this morning to talk about these offices and get an update on staffing and how they're going. One thing that we think we could be helpful with actually is helping. Like, there's a lot of research to be done on these topics. So when people talk about missing and murdered Black women and girls, the you know, there's a lot of, I think it triggers some stereotypes, right? And like, is this human trafficking? Is this kidnapped children? You know, and really, why are we not focused on men? And really, like, it encompasses all of that, including men, right? These resources can be used to find African-American men who I believe are missing at a higher rate than African-American women currently. But because of the nature of domestic violence and sexual assault, it makes 100%, it's reasonable to me to focus on the experiences of Black women and prioritize those experiences. And I think we have a lot to learn from those experiences, not just to keep women safe, let me be clear, but to help men, Black men, people like myself, understand what world these women are living in and how I can be a better brother and how I can be a better ally in making sure that we have a more healthy version of masculinity out here that empowers women to be more safer and more and seek more opportunity within society.
I'm looking at the website for the Minnesota Department of Public Safety and its Office of Justice Programs. And that's where the information about the missing and murdered Black women and girls day on the Hill is posted. And I'll just share that out. I don't know if Jared, you can pull this up and post it online so people can see it as I'm looking at it. But this event is Wednesday, April 9th, 2025 at 11 o'clock. And it's going to be at the State Capitol Rotunda at 75 Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard over in St. Paul. And the idea, they say in this promotion, is that history is being made, that and they're inviting the community, the public, to stand with them, to stand with us, it says. And the note, the invitation, asks people, Minnesotans, to join for the first ever Missing and Murdered Black Women and Girls Day on the Hill. It's more than an event, they say. It's a powerful day of action, of remembrance and change, that together, those assembled and all of our colleagues and families and friends and neighbors in the state will shine a light on Minnesota's missing and murdered Black women and girls. They will honor and elevate the stories of those who have been taken too soon, and they will mobilize for solutions for transformative actions. I think it's a noble calling. So they're saying they want you, listeners here on KFAI and those on our social media platforms, to be a part of history and gather for the inaugural Missing and Murdered Black Women and Girls Day on the Hill, to bring your voice and your presence and your commitment that they all matter. And there's a link to more places you can get information. I think that's important work. And I think the work that Shane referenced earlier, highlighting and focusing on missing and murdered indigenous women as well, it's critical for all of us at this time. Justin, I probably have asked you this before, but, and you sort of opened the door for this by saying, I talked about your previous work at the Council on Minnesotans of African Descent. What, and you mentioned too that you're a social worker, not a lawyer. Give us an idea of what your background. How do you come to this work? And what's your personal family story?
Yeah, absolutely. Can I just say about this event you're promoting real quick,
sure,
though?
Sure.
You know, right now the trend is if you invite, you know, 20 people to an event, you're going to get 40, because people are feeling the pressure of the madness in the world right now and from our local governments. And so I just want to encourage your listeners, if you're like, oh, that might be a good thing for me to check out, like, just go ahead and accept that you finna go and make plans to go and show up, because this is the time that we need to be in community spaces with each other talking about these issues. And so I just really want to encourage people not to doubt that voice in their head that's like, I should probably go to that. No, put it on your calendar and show up. So my background is pretty simple. So, I grew up in South Minneapolis. My family experienced homelessness, domestic violence, all kinds of, you know, craziness that, you know, a lot of families in our community experience. And so, you know, for me, I got into social work thinking, really, like, I just wanted to work with families like mine. And so I became a youth worker, you know, which is how I met my wife, is doing youth work. And after working with young people, I worked with the homeless adult population, with brothers coming home from prison. And then one day I was at work, and there was in the Ramsey County Men's Shelter, and a kid I used to work with back in the day, who was closer to adult age, showed up looking for services in the adult shelter. And I almost quit my job the same day. I was like, to hell with this. Pardon my language if we're not supposed to say that. Because I knew that this kid faced like some serious barriers, and I knew that he was kind of a knucklehead at times. And if he's listening, like, he knows who he is, and he knows how much I love him. And it's like, you can be a knucklehead sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. But you ain't got no business showing up at an adult shelter. Mm-hmm. You know, let's go talk to your auntie or whomever, you know, mm-hmm. your coach, whomever. Let's find you a place to crash tonight and figure out how to get you and, you know, get you going. And that showed me right there that, like, there needed to be an intervention. There needs to be more interventions. There needs to be more recognition of the folks who do let kids crash on their couches and are consistent, safe adults for people. And so I went back to grad school to study policy, because I figured that's maybe where I could help move resources to the community. And in the process of doing that, I learned how to organize, dropped out halfway through my master's, became an organizer, led the Justice for All program. We developed, you know, several folks who run for office, several folks who became organizers. I had a full-time organizer, young lady by the name of Candace Montgomery, who went on to help lead Black Lives Matter and caused all that noise. And so, you know, my background is really, I'm an organizer, I'm a social worker, I'm someone who's put in over 10 years of service to our community as a social worker, has been an organizer for, you know, almost 10 years, and then became an executive and leading, you know, one legacy Black institution. And now I'm trying to build another one so I could use folks' help. But we've been active for 5 years here at the MNJRC, and we have some receipts that we're very proud of.
Lineage-wise, what's your family story? Whose shoulders do you stand on?
Lord have mercy, man. We ain't got time for that story. I just found out the other day that apparently, like, one of my great-great aunts was, like, used to raise Siberian cats in Ohio. So I'm somebody, you know, I definitely study my history as a Black man, right? So I've been to the homestead in Texas where my family, you know, planted its roots after slavery, right? Mm-hmm. And there's stories about lynchings and KKK raids that I've tried to research to get to know the full story, because I want to know the full story. I haven't quite completed that research, but it's something that I'm still looking into. So that's on my mom's side. We originated out of Texas after slavery. And, you know, through white terrorism in the South, relocated to California, and ultimately great migration to Minnesota. A lot of us, our families in Minnesota went through that, right? Mm-hmm. And so my mom, I'll just speak about my mom as one set of shoulders I stand on. This is a Black woman who, you know, experienced domestic violence, who experienced homelessness, who worked three jobs. She joked she had a job for each one of her kids, me and my two sisters. Mm-hmm. And you know, watched her go from homeless to homeowner, right? Mm-hmm. And so I grew up really understanding that I need to work my behind off if I'm going to take care of myself, but I also want to help other families like my mom, you know, women like my mom who were in charge of the family trying to raise these kids in a crazy environment. And then I got into social justice work because in the fifth grade, I got expelled for kicking my teacher. I was one of them bad kids. It's a good thing they didn't have spam back then, because they'd have signed me up. And so I was home, I remember suspended, and I was watching Channel 2 randomly, and I saw Eyes on the Prize. And so I recorded all of those, watched them on repeat on a VHS. And then one day after Eyes on the Prize, you know, the Ballad of the Bullet came on and it was over. And I read the autobiography of Malcolm X when I was 10 years old. And that's really what set me on a path towards that, combined with my faith later on and my mentors in high school, with people like Wiley Scott, you know, people like Brian Smith, you know, brothers who really looked out for me when I was a kid. That's really what helped me figure out that I was going to dedicate my life, or I felt called to dedicate my life, to be obedient, to try to serve my community, advance justice, and be an example of God's love and grace and mercy in this world. And so that's how I hope people experience me. I have no idea, but
I think that's a mic drop. Thank you. I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland, my guest, Justin Terrell, and thanks to my previous guest, Shane Solier. Great conversation, man. Great work. Thank you so much. We will see you next time. Take care.